just a couple of things. I want this to be very discussion-oriented, actually, so that's fine. I have some handouts for you to take a look at that are from the book. Really, the purpose of the book, just a little about me. I've been a pastor in the Church of the Nazarene for about 25 years. I've been an adjunct professor for 17 of those years at various universities, including right now here. I teach one course per term at MNU as an adjunct, and I'm now affiliate associate professor of theology and ethics for Fuller Seminary. So I teach two courses per year for them somewhere, one of their extensions usually. Like tomorrow, I'm on a plane to Texas. I'm teaching at Fuller, Texas tomorrow. And then in the fall, Fuller, Seattle, and then next summer, Texas and Phoenix. That should be fun. But anyway, so they keep me jumping a little bit. But my main job is I'm the pastor of the Church of the Nazarene in Cameron, Missouri, which is about an hour from this place. I've been there about 3.5 years. So that whole process of my PhD is in theology and ethics. I got my MDiv and my PhD while I was pastoring. And I was adjunct teaching along the way. And more, I have had more and more teaching opportunities, and with that, more and more writing opportunities. I've published about 40 articles and reviews for various publications. Now it's coming on 50, I think. This is my first solo book. I've contributed to a couple of books. In fact, one that just came out yesterday through the publishing house. I'm not selling that or anything, but I can show it to you because someone just handed it to me. Essential Beliefs. It's Mark Maddox and Diane LeClaire edited it. I have a chapter in here. So that ministry has always been a part of my pastoral ministry. And so because of that, in conversation with our publishing house over the years, last couple of years, there was a spot for an introduction to Christian ethics, particularly geared toward pastors and mentors as well. So that could mean new pastors who are just getting into ministry, or pastors who've been around for a while who are like me. I have a small staff, and you may have a large staff, but I have a staff, and so I'm mentoring those folks on my staff. And so the materials that I have used with staff through the years are part of this book, as well as just a more formal introduction to Christian ethics that then trickles down into very specific ways of applying Christian ethics to the day-to-day stuff that we face in ministry. So that's the part I'm most excited about, because it really is a book that is, it has an academic flavor. It's very, very practical, it seems to me. Hopefully it seems to them too. The idea of the book, even though now the new title is Ethics in Christian Ministry, is what I call preventative maintenance. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. If you want to get this to work here, that'd be good. What's going on? Sorry, I got to make sure my technology is working. There we go. Good. And this little meme I started with: what if I told you that pastors should make theologically informed decisions? That sounds elementary and basic, but unfortunately, as you know, so many trends come and go, especially in the last 20 or 30 years of church life, that not all our decisions, even on a denominational level, get made from a soundly theological perspective. The danger of that is, of course, that we end up sometimes acting differently than what we really are. We act more, let's say, like a business, or like a counseling firm, or like simply a nonprofit. And all those things are good things, by the way, and we as the church do all of that in some way. But we are the church, and we have a unique identity, and we have a unique base from which to work. And so that's what this book tries to do, is to recapture that base a little bit more. I can't see this as well as I would hope, but so I want to discuss a little, just really quickly, just give me a couple of things that are tough ethical issues for pastors. Just throw them out. What are some of the things that pastors wrestle with? The LGBT community, how to minister to the LGBT community, is probably the biggest topic, and you've seen there's a lot of even workshops on that today at PowCon. Good. What else? Ethical issues that we face, or you can add professional issues that give you the most concern, the things you do day to day, whether it's very practically like managing money, or all the way to handling conflict or counseling people, or I think I just named three right there probably, but any others like that that you...
We ran into one where there were $300,000 on the table, and the way we could get it was to modify our approach to ministry and turn our Christian bent or language into more benign language.
Right, yeah.
More politically correct language.
Sure.
Not necessarily change the program, but change the language in our... and so the concern was, you know, where's your integrity at that point, you know?
Right. Yes, yeah. What? How far do you bend when you're faced with those potential ministry opportunities? Great question. And I think those are the kinds of things, for instance, this book tries to tackle, at least in a preventative way. And a big question is, what resources do you have as a minister that assist you in navigating these difficulties? The good news is there are a lot of those kinds of resources out there. The attempt of this book is to try to put kind of a launching pad version of those in one place. So you won't get everything about everything in one place. Obviously, no book except the Bible maybe can do that. But you will get kind of a launching pad for key areas of pastoral ministry. And the idea is to use a real grid, a systematic way of thinking through these kind of tough ethical decisions. So these four areas in this grid are theological. In other words, is this decision in keeping with Christian doctrinal norms? And that goes back to, is this about who we are as a Christian, or does it maintain our Christian distinctives? Is it in harmony with the mission of Christ? So there's the first area of discussion we tackle a little bit. Is it relationally, does it foster a healthy environment for strong Christ-honoring relationships, this decision? Is this decision going to be in keeping with it? That has to do with the process as well, right? And then priorities. Is this decision, whatever area it is in, is it going to demonstrate the stated priorities of the church? Sometimes, as you know, churches, like many organizations, just sort of do things on the fly because it sounds good at the moment. Individuals do that too, but and it sometimes can become costly for our priorities, right? If someone comes to you and says, "I have, I have this freezer for food for the homeless," and you have no way of, your church doesn't yet have that priority, there's going to be work to be done before you can make that decision. It's that kind of thing. And then character, does this maintain good reputation? How many times do we unfortunately see on the news, it does make the news, churches that say things, especially around this political season, or make certain decisions that harm the reputation of the church or of Christ? And so a good question is, will this harm our reputation, especially in this community? Are we being sensitive to what this community is about by making this decision? So I think that's kind of the grid that we work with. The areas of ministry covered in the book, first of all, just really quickly, the minister is professional, what kind of professional we are and what kind we're not. So these are kind of the chapters that go into this. The minister's priorities, how to keep our relationships in their proper place, you know, making sure that doesn't get twisted around. How we communicate, we're going to do a little sample thing about that in a second. How we handle conflict, because conflict's inevitable, preparing for the inevitable. How the ethics of care and counseling. And right, a lot of what we do is we're present with people, and sometimes we're present with people. Often we're present with people in crisis, right, the most difficult times in their lives. Well, there are boundaries that need to be respected ethically when we enter into counseling situations. And you and I know. I mean, the number one, I like some of you, I've been on boards of ministry for 18 years probably. And you get to see the really good in those boards of ministry, like men and women, district licensed and ordained and doing great stuff. But you also... on credentials boards, right, you get to see the other side when things don't go so well. And there are studies that say this, but you don't even need a study to know. If I were to ask you, what are the big two things that kill ministries, what are they?
Sexual
morality and money. Yeah, sex and money. Those are the two things. And so Most of the time, if we know that we're having a meeting in regard to someone about to lose their credentials, it's most of the time it's one of those two things. You could set your watch by it. It's that way. And it has to do with the sex part often has to do with how we do care and counseling. Because most of the time it is the care and counseling aspect. Pastor, can I come by? My marriage is in trouble. Great, we want to be there for you. But how I end up, what kind of boundaries I set, how I approach this problem ethically, will eventually have ramifications for whether I end up in front of that committee or not. Right? So those are the kind of things we talk about as well. The minister is preacher and worshiper. We have, for the sake of a flash, or for the sake of just getting rears in the seats, we have sometimes sacrificed our theological foundation in regard to what we are as a worshiping community, what our worship implies about ethics. That might be my favorite one because I'm a musician and started out as both youth and worship pastor early on, and been a senior pastor for most of that time. But talking about those kind of questions, the worship wars and all that kind of stuff is addressed there. The minister and the business of the church. Again, taming the green monster is what it's called. I mean, that's the second area, that money area, right? If the counseling doesn't get you, the way you do business might. I remember I had a mentor who's now a district superintendent in another state, but when I first started out, my first pastor in the early 90s, a little church that we were doing a restart, we know what that was, but we were doing it, and I was in seminary, it was in Texas, and I remember going to this little seminar with it was called the Rookie Pastors Meeting, right? And so we had mentors there and had rookie pastors in a room kind of like this. And it was his job to talk about the business of the church. And he stood up and he went, I want to ask each of you, how long do you want to be in ministry? That's how he started his presentation. That's how serious. He goes, well, part of the way you answer that question is going to be how you do the business of the church. So this isn't just about he said he was afraid we were going to be bored, right? He said, this isn't just a boring money lecture. This is about how long you're going to be in the pastorate. Got our attention. We listened very carefully in that meeting, and he was right. Right, the way we do business, the way we handle finances, the way we do business within the church and within the community. Right, and that maybe goes back to your illustration too. I mean, we have a relationship with the community that sometimes crosses over into a business relationship with the community, contractors, and folks like that. I mean, we're going to be judged on that as well. Even within employees, right? People we bring on staff, people who we bring on to assist with janitorial stuff, even all the way up to whatever, associate ministers and pastors. We have ethical and legal obligations that, isn't it sad? I should say, wouldn't it be, but we don't have to speculate. Isn't it sad when we see good ministries tanked because they've handled the IRS wrong, or they've handled the state income tax wrong, or they've handled... I mean, we did a restart in Ohio where I got there in my second month there. Never happened to me before in ministry up to that point. I got a visit from an IRS agent, and his first question is, how long have you been here? 2 months. It's my second month here. I'm just learning what's going on. He said, good, because if you'd have told me any longer than, if you told me you've been here a year or more, I'm ready to put a lien on your building. And I'm like, what the heck is that? I mean, what was that about? And he says, here, and he showed me, and that church, unfortunately, in its interim and before, I won't go into great detail, but the pastor had gone through some moral difficulty, and a lot of the balls got dropped along the way, and basically, they owed the IRS $45,000. And then they owed the state another $8,000 on top of that. And so the Lord, in that 2 years, the Lord got us out of that. But I mean, honestly, my wife and I became amateur tax accountants for about 6 months. amateur. Unfortunately, we got a real one. But that's the kind of... I mean, and here was a ministry trying to restart. Very excited. We've got a new pastor now. We've got a new connection with the university. We've got some new things happening. We're very excited. Oh yeah, but that preschool that we had, we didn't take out enough taxes for the employees for about 8 months, and so we're so oh yeah, and we're the board, right? We're the board not only for the church, we're also the board for that, and so they were that close for that issue, crumbling everything else like a house of cards. So That's an important chapter. And then again, falling and failing in ministry, creating an environment of grace. Man, that's who we are and what we're about as well. Preventative maintenance is not a catch-all. The book is not. My approach is not. Our approach is not a detailed how-to. It's preparing an ethical basis. It's taking seriously our role as theologians in our congregation or in our places of leadership. We've got to recapture that. You don't have to have a PhD in theology to be the theologian of your ministry. In fact, you're expected to be. And you know it because you'll get questions about theology, but also the congregation and the community look to us to be functional theologians, people who actually live out this theology that we say we believe. Preparing to improvise through the development of Christ-like character within a consistent ethical system, and that's what we're going to talk about. Recapturing the normality of theological constructs and language, utilize language and methods from other disciplines, but only when filtered through the ways of Christ. Okay? There's the thing that usually whips our witness, right? We say something like, well, we need to function with healthy business models, but we often adopt business models without any filter. Right? You see that? That's scary when that happens, and it eventually comes back to bite us, relationally or in our reputation or something else. Or we say, well, we've got to get people in. So we use the language and tools of marketing, which those aren't sinful. My undergrad degree is in marketing. It's not necessarily bad, but we don't filter that approach through the person and work and ways of Christ. So in other words, we step out of who we really are as the church and try to function that way, which leads to an ethical crisis most of the time, and certainly an identity crisis all the time. And then to apply a distinctly Christian approach to decisions in the church life, rooted in the theology and liturgy of the church. In other words, recapturing our identity and saying, we're going to work from this basis. We're going to be who we are in these decisions, which is a slower way to grow, by the way, sometimes. But it is actually a deeper way to grow. I call it ministry jazz. I'm a musician, so you have to bear with me. Ministry jazz. The ethical approach that I recommend for us as pastors is something that you guys already are going to be familiar with, and that is what one writer calls improvisation as the key to ethics. Samuel Wells, you'll see the book in here in a second. Improvisation in music is rooted in basic knowledge. You guys like jazz at all? Anybody? If you don't, it's okay. You like whatever music you like, rock and roll, country music even, whatever, bluegrass especially, I like bluegrass as well. But there's a lot of improv involved. The most fun parts of the song are when the musicians cut loose, man. I mean, I've been a jazz musician. I played saxophone and guitar and some piano. My kids are now in jazz programs, and they're loving it. One's trumpet, one's saxophone. And the biggest thing, because I used to play with bands and stuff, and they go, Dad, teach me how to improvise. Like, this song has a solo in it, Dad. It's in the key of G, and it's got some transition. Can you show me how to just do an improv? And my next question to them is always, what's the music? What's the tune? What's the melody? Well, that's hard. I don't know that yet. I just want to learn to improvise. Well, here's the problem with that, right? You can't improvise until you know the music. The best improv folks are so well trained in the very basics of music, right? That, man, by the time they cut loose, it's going to be right, because it's going to be in the right key. And it may alter the melody, but it's going to be within the same key of the melody. And so that's, isn't that pastoral ministry, though? I mean, we go to seminary or undergrad or both or whatever, and we train and we get the very basics that we need, and we are immersed in those, and we're supposed to be. You know, we know something about hermeneutics. We know something about theology. We know something about church history. We know something about communication and preaching, because we're supposed to. That's our core thing, and we're supposed to get very, very familiar with that, so that on Monday, when Tom comes in and says, my wife's about to leave me, what am I going to do? Or when Jane comes and says, I really don't like that style of music. I'd rather a different style. Or when Sam comes in and says, look, Pastor, I know you guys are in a little bit of financial issue. I can do some under-the-table business for you. and get this taken care of. All of these three things sound logical, I guess, or at least sound like things, but that is when you can't go, what page was that on in my systematic? You know, I mean, it's in there, but you're going to have to improv, right? You're going to have to improv. And the mistake we often make, I know in my own ministry, has been I've improvised in the wrong key. You know what I mean? I've simply adapted some other hat. I put on a different hat and improvised over here in the wrong key, thinking, well, that'll fix it. But in the long run, it comes back to bite me. And I think that's the danger. And that's why this idea of being proactive versus reactive, you know, the old mechanic sign, right? Pay me now or pay me later. So preventative maintenance is about paying me now, so to speak. It's about saying, I want to be grounded in what it means to be the church's theologian, even if I don't have a PC in it or whatever, so that when it's time to improvise, right, then I know what key to improvise in. I'm not improvising in someone else's key. That makes sense? Any thoughts on that? Any questions on that? I mean, this is just the me part, your part coming, because I got
the basis of that. What would the basis of that be? That theology.
Right. Well, here you go. I mean, this is we're going to talk about that really quick too. Distinctively Christian measurements. The importance of what you just asked is measured in these two recent statistics. The cause of both burnout and career dissatisfaction among ministers includes a low sense of value regarding the work of the ministry. And I believe with all my heart, and after years of looking into this and writing this book and whatever, I think that that is so directly tied to not having a basis, not having a sense of value from whence or from where we work. You know what I mean? In other words, it's pastors at the end of their career that I've even interviewed that have said, I wish I'd gone to law school. I wish I'd gone to business school. You start asking them about what they do in the pastorate, and they say, well, I did some marketing here. I did some HR management here. You know what I mean? And there's no sense of the pastor finding a sense of identity in his or her own theological grounding. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. The low sense of value is rooted in the co-opting of both values and language that is based on other professions. And again, all these other professions are important: business, politics, therapy, law. But they're not the key we sing in or that we play in. And the goal of preventive maintenance is applying ethical principles is done through improvisation. It's a great ethics book. I'll skip some of that. But what is an ethical system? Let's just do that really quick. The system of evaluating what is right, good, or best. I like ethics because ethicists get to say, that's not right. Other professions, other even disciplines in theology go, here are the options, right? You can be a premillennial eschatology person, or you can be a postmillennial eschatologist. Here are the options out there. Ethicists get to come in and go, that's not right. Or that's correct. That's a good thing. That's the best thing. That's the job of the ethics part of our calling. So ethics, when you talk about an ethical system, it is based on what is right, or it's a system evaluating based upon some authority. And authority is whatever changes your attitudes or behaviors, by the way. We often make authority equal to power. But power-based authority is only one little aspect of authority, right? And you know that's right. Like if Joe twisted my arm and said, give me $5 or whatever, he wouldn't do that. But let's say he did, then, and I gave him $5. The minute he left, I'd be trying to get that $5 back. So, but while he's exerting power over me, it is temporary, right? So power-based authority is temporary. It has to do with proximity. But there are other forms of authority, more internally based, more compelling kinds of authority that are more long-term, right? So that's what we're talking about. So a system of ethics is based on some authority. It is systematic and consistent. It is community driven. It's based on, it's not done in a vacuum. In other words, it takes seriously the community. And so for Christians, plugging in those three things, God and God's ways expressed in Christ, interpreted by the church, form the boundaries of the system. That's square one. So what is our system based on? What's the authority in our system? The ways of Jesus. I like to put it that way. People say Jesus. I mean, of course, but that sounds too broad to me. So I have to be very specific because ethics is also pretty specific. I say the ways of Jesus, how Jesus would act. Well, how do we know? Based on what the Scripture says and how the church through the centuries has interpreted that. That becomes square one. That's where we've signed up. Right? That's where we've made our commitment, especially if you're ordained or licensed or whatever. You've said, okay, I'm lining up here. This will become the source of my authority. Which means what? Which means this will determine my behavior change, my attitude change, my action change. This is my authority. Scripture, the call of God through the church, denominational and local sources are included in that, right? On a different scale. And the community in which we function is the church. We take seriously what the church says and what it means when it defines stuff. We take that seriously. We take seriously the impact our actions have on the reputation of the church because we believe it is the means by which God does his mission in the world. Think about that. So, the cool part of this, just for you, I know most of your pastors, or maybe all of you are. All of you, Pastor?
I'm not.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm just saying the fun part for pastors is the businessman or woman in your congregation is accountable to the church. I like remind in a nice way reminding people of that. Like, you know, if they're going to do something. I went and visited a CEO once of a pretty big company when I was pastoring in Seattle. And I'm sitting there in his nice office in a nice chair and just chatting with him. And I go, the first question, you know, we're friends, but I mean, he's a little older. And I said, so how often do you see your wife and kids these days? I mean, he looked at me like I had just slapped him in the face. Because he thought I was there, and I've done that before, to get some business advice from him or ask him about something in the community. Or, you know, because he knew. Right, he'd been in the community 25 years and owned the business and, you know, did well. But I was there to be his pastor, right? And I went, how often? And he just, I said, are you okay? He goes, nobody in this building has the guts to ask me that question. I said, well, you can't fire me. And you're part of the church, right? He goes, yeah, Pastor. Well, I'm asking, right? So this is where we derive. My job isn't to go in there and just market to him to get his money. My job is to be his pastor. I have a different ethical key that I'm singing in than he's accustomed to. That's what I mean. So that's what we mean by saying the community that we are accountable to and that we function is the church. And when the church starts being the church, like, and you know, let me tell you how that panned out later on. It was a little awkward for a while because it turns out there was some issues. But later on, there was a time, 6-7 months down the road, Pastor, I need to meet with you. Came in, met with me in the office, you know, very important guy, so I'm always careful of his time. I want to, you know, kind of get him out of there. And he goes, I'm about to fire somebody, and I'd like to talk to you about it. And I'm thinking, I don't fire a lot of people. I don't even hire a lot of people. You know, I mean, I have some staff, but I mean, that's about it. I'm not an HR guy. And I said, well, look, you've done that more than I have ever done it. He goes, no, I want to talk to you about the Christ-like way to fire this guy. That's when I knew that there was some good improv happening, right? That's the difference. That's what we offer as the church, even to the business community. And too often we've seen business over here, politics over here, whatever. Well, if you're part of the church, the community that you do ethics in is the church, first of all. You're accountable. You're responsible. If you go and mess somebody around, I almost said something different, mess somebody around in the community, that's not just between you and the lawyers and that guy. The church has something to say about it because you're a part of the community of Christ. So that's really what, and that sounds new, not to you guys, but I mean, when you say that out loud, you know, to people, it sounds kind of new, but it's actually the way the church has always functioned. It's just that we've sometimes abandoned that. So, All right, let me keep going, get out of here. Two big approaches to ethics. There's one, you don't have to know all this stuff. I do one chapter that's like the technical chapter, and the rest are kind of better, more practical. But there's an approach called deontological or duty-based or sometimes called non-consequentials. Here's why it's called that. This approach does not care what the consequences are. It just says that is right, and that's always going to be right, and I don't care if the whole building burns down, this is right. Okay, that approach to ethics is sort of the to-die-for approach. And there are things like that, amen, right? There are things like that in life. There are things you'll go, I don't care what happened, this is right, and this is going to be right, and I don't care what the consequences are, I'm going to stand up for this. Yes? So, that's fine. It's just called something in ethics. It's technically called duty, but duty, deon is the word duty, D-U-T-Y. So if you think of it that way, deon, duty-based, deontological, or Kantian, because it's associated with this guy named Immanuel Kant who wrote stuff back in the 1700s, but he made it famous, but it's always been around. Decisions regarding right and wrong are made up front regardless of consequences. Another approach is called teleological, telos, remember? The end, or the result, the goal, or consequentialist. Why? Because we care about the consequence. We evaluate right and wrong on these issues based on how it turns out, right? Or based on how it multiplies the love of God in the world, or some basis like that, right? And again, these things exist too, right? There are some things when you go, I mean, it could go either way. So which going to turn out the best, right? Or when two duties are combating each other. You're walking by a property that says keep off city government property, and yet you hear there's a pond on that property, and you hear a little kid going, help, help, I'm drowning. Well, what's just happened? What's it? How many of you believe it's the duty of all citizens to obey the law as best you can? I agree. How many of you believe that human life is very valuable? Raise your hand. So what has just happened there? Two deons, two duties have competed. So you're forced to become consequentialist. You say, which one is better? These are both important, but one is more important than the other. The minute you do that, you're being consequentialist. So we do both every day, is my point. And so that approach to ethics is more about, okay, if I walk on by, the cops aren't going to be mad at me for, or the mayor or whatever, not going to be mad at me for trespassing, but that kid's going to die, right? But if I break this little law and risk a fine or whatever, I'm going to save this kid's life. So I'm going to go ahead and say, I hope that you would all agree with me. Saying, if not, we got some counseling to do. No, but you would agree with me that I'm going to go save the kid's life. I'm going to go ahead and break that one law in order, because there's a higher law. So I've just made a consequentialist decision. All right. And these are some famous people that John Stuart Mill and Joseph Fletcher that are famous for writing about that. And then finally, when you combine those in a way, no system is purely one or the other. Ray Dunning, who many of you know, Nazarene, says that most people see biblical ethics as just duty-based. Everything is duty. I do this because that's just right. There are many things like that. But he argues that the Wesleyan approach emphasizes the consequentialist approach as well, because Wesley reminded us that the key, the central theological action in the Bible is love. Right? So when I'm faced with a decision, especially when two duties collide, I'm going to ask, what is the most loving in that regard? So that's what our ethical decision-making is really based on. I mean, we have some things to die for, no doubt. We have some things that are going to be right. They're just going to be right. If the whole church splits, it's too bad. You know what I mean? Like, there are some things you say, well, Pastor, we really don't like the doctrine of Trinity, so could you not preach that anymore? And then I'm going to preach the doctrine of the Trinity. We don't like that whole Jesus died for you stuff. Can you not mention that? And I'm going to mention that. Well, then 70% of us are going to leave. Well, then you're just going to have to go. Right? Because there are some things, it's my duty, right? They're just going to be right. However, there are many things in ethics that we go, well, that's just better than that. They're both good, but this one's better. And this one's more loving. I could get away or could do this and it'd be okay, but this is the more loving, so I'm going to do that. Still with me? That's how we do ethics. That's how we're called to do them as a Christian. And as we're exposed to the person of Christ, the ways of Christ, through Eucharistic worship, through liturgy, through singing, through the preaching of the Word, then we become transformed. Our character, right? becomes transformed. And when that happens, that's called, there's a name for that, there's always a name for it, Christian virtue ethics. It's when we allow the Spirit of God, through the exposure to the church, through Jesus, through Scripture, and through the ways of God, to transform us. Okay. And so a lot of these folks, talk about virtue ethics, I won't do that. So let me do a specific application let me give you this. And then have you do a case study. See, I told you it's going to be more fun after a while. I know, you never know how many you make. They tell me to make a lot, so I did. Okay, if you'll take one, just pass that one on, pass one on down. In my very first pastorate, like I said, I told you it was a restart church that I didn't know what that was, but it technically was. They'd been through a split. They went from 120 down to 35 people. And I'd been a youth pastor for 2.5 years. I was just barely in seminary, just married. I had been married 1 month when the DS said, they're voting on you, and we want you to come and be their pastor. Anyway, that was my weird life. So I walked into that situation. The DS did his best to sort of counsel me on what to expect. And basically the first thing he said was, these people don't talk to each other very much because they're angry over the split they've gone through in the last 3 years. And those that stayed are very devoted, very committed to the church. Most of them have been here a long time. And he said, Charles, by the way, most of your board is your parents' or grandparents' age. So be aware of that. No pressure, right? And they don't all talk to each other very well, because there's still some bruised feelings over the previous stuff that went on. Great. Hey, thanks for telling me. You know, that was my first DS lesson, by the way. Yeah, you've all had them, but that was my first one. I'm like, oh, that's what opportunity means in DS language. So just so you'll know, he's going to start putting out resumes. He's a student of mine. But so that's what that means. That's what it could mean. That's what it meant. And so I said, well, what am I going to do about that? I just started seminary. I've just got my district license like a year and a half ago. I don't know what to do a year ago. I have a degree in marketing. I can do some marketing research and tell them why their neighborhood is dying. I can do that. I know how to do that. I can probably preach a little bit. I mean, that's about it. He goes, well, can you get them to talk to each other? I don't know. You're older than me. You can't. So I don't think I can. He goes, well, pray about that. Make that. Come up with something. And my wife was doing her master's degree in counseling. Get with your wife. Come up with something to help them communicate better. All right. So here's what happened. This is a communication covenant for ministers and congregations that, based on some prayer and some conversation and reading the Bible and stuff like that that we do, became this ten-point thing that we introduced right before the end of the church year. So that was several months from our first day. I sat with the nominating committee, which was basically that board, and said, look, why don't we do this thing that says, because there are qualifications, and I've read the manual, some of it, and at that time, I've read all of it now, but that say that there's some qualifications to be a leader in the church. Everybody agree with that? Yeah. Yes, Pastor. Yeah, you're right. I said, well, can we sort of make this a part of what we ask people to say before they even get on the ballot? Everybody okay with that? And just because they were being nice to me, and they thought, hey, he's doing something new, that's what I think, and they felt sorry for me, I think, they went, okay, Pastor, that would be good. Put that in the letter. Great. We did our little nominations, and I sent out a letter that had this covenant and said, if you're willing to sign this covenant, then you can be on the ballot. If you're not, then it's okay. You don't have to be on the ballot. You're not on the ballot. And I had three board members not be on the ballot because of this, but I got three new board members who were willing to do this, and I ended up with six on the board, like you're supposed to, you know. Yeah. And life got a little better. And from then on, these people, whenever someone would come to them as we started to grow a little bit, I ended up writing an article about this. I sent this to an older, wiser, much larger church pastor to say, what do you think of this? And he said, you ought to write it as an article. And one of the first articles in 1999, Leadership Journal published this, a version of this, as an article that's now been reproduced and used, and I put it in this book as well. It's been around for 16 years. I found out that there are now, in fact, that one bishop I told you about, the Episcopal bishop in Washington, makes all, I didn't even know he had it. He makes all of his pastors sign it before that he appoints them. So it's gotten a lot of mileage, and it's been translated into a couple of publications, one in Portuguese, one in Spanish. So it's gotten a lot. I'm like, wow, that's like the easiest thing I've ever written, in a way. It wasn't like this scholarly research thing that I've done since then. It was just this little thing like, here's how we're going to talk to each other, or we're going to die. So let's not die. You know, that's really what that came from. And so this became the basis by which we did it. Let me just, the way that ended, or was it, we ended up staying there 5 years. The church grew. The guy who followed me there is still there. He's about to retire from there. And that, I left there in 1998. So he's still there. The church is strong. It's now very multicultural. It's now, you know, doing some great things in this community. Not just because of us, but I think God used this, my ignorance and my thing of like, all I know is the Bible tells you how to communicate, and this is how we ought to communicate. That was not very profound, but that was it. And so this, here's how I knew it was working. Again, you have to always test things like this. A couple years down the road, we started growing a little bit. We had a new worship leader. He was a student from a local Bible college. Frankly, wasn't that good, to be honest with you. But he was willing and available and a good kid. So, you know, he was our guy for a while, and it kept me from doing it, so that made me happy. And so, you know, and there was a couple of folks of an advanced age, let's say, in our church who just couldn't stand it. I mean, you know, just like, this is terrible. You know? Instead of calling me, they called one of my board members who was the matriarch of the church. Everybody knows what that is. It's like the woman who secretly runs everything. Maybe not so secretly in that case. Who had been, in fact, this woman had been at this church since 1946. That's a long time. She had a good tenure there, right? And she's wonderful, by the way. She's in her 90s now. I got to see her not long ago. She's still a friend of our family's. Wonderful, wonderful human being. But she was kind of the go-to person, especially during times of crisis in that church. So they came to her and they said, and they called her by name. I won't say her name. And they said, would you please tell the pastor? You know how that's going to go, right? Mm-hmm. Would you please tell the pastor that, this isn't his name, but that Jeff needs to not be doing that anymore, and that many of us are insistent upon it. She tells me later, she hung up the phone and she said, okay, I'll talk with them, because that was her go-to thing, because she's the matriarch of the church. She's accustomed to that. Okay, I'll talk to him. Thanks for calling. Hung up the phone. She said later, you know what I did for that pastor? I remembered this communication covenant that I had signed before I got on the board. And the first one says what? If you have a problem with me, come to me privately. And she said, I had violated that one, because I told them I would come to you instead of sending them to you. Because the next one basically says, the third one, if someone has a problem with me and comes to you, send them to me, and I'll do the same for you. And she said, I'd violated number three for sure, because I told them I would just go without sending them or without coming with them. Anyway, long story short, she called them back and said, the pastor really likes it. Now think of the credibility I just gained as a young, you know, early mid-20s, know-nothing preacher in this established church that had been through some crisis. When the matriarch of the church, who'd been there since 1946, called both these women separately. They were together, in fact, when they called her, but she called them separately at their homes and said, the pastor really likes it when you come to him one-on-one with an issue like that. I would rather you go. Now, if he won't see you, you call me and I'll come with you. And so, without me knowing, on a Sunday night, well, Sunday afternoon after church, they said, Pastor, are you going to be here early for Sunday night service? I said, yes, we'll be here. We want to talk to you. Great. I didn't know any of this other stuff at the time. They come in. They express their concerns about Jeff. Turns out I had also talked to Jeff about this stuff and was able to sort of ease their minds about some of that. And before they left, I went, you know, before you ladies go, I want to thank you for coming to me. It means a lot to me that you came to me directly. And I noticed they looked kind of awkward as they got up and left, because they originally hadn't done that. The reason I found out the rest of the story is that night after church, the matriarch lady came to her and said, "Pastor, I got to ask you a question. Did," and she named these two ladies, Jane and, you know, Sue. "Did Jane and Sue talk to you tonight?" I said, "Yeah. Yeah, they did. They came to me. I'm really not comfortable telling you the details." "Oh, no, I don't want any details." She said, "In fact, I want you to know I know the details. And I had almost violated our communication covenant, but I sent them to you." And of course, what did I say to her? "Thank you. Thank you." That's, I believe, the best way to communicate. And so God used this little covenant to, you know, by the time we left, thankfully, the church had grown and people were actually talking to each other and the board was getting along. And, you know, God, I mean, just through those little simple things. So there's that. There are things that stop us from doing that in a healthy way. And I'm almost done, but I want to give you a list of a few things that aren't on here that I think can help us really fast. Just a few communication killers. The first is avoidance. It's the easiest way. It's just not dealing with it at all. Now, some things need to wait and simmer a little bit. I understand that. But avoidance is when we take that a step further and say, "I'm just not going to deal with it. I'm going to see what happens." So that's a communication killer. Second one, passive-aggressive communication. Everybody know what that is, right? That's when someone is either tries to get to you indirectly through a behavior that is not direct confrontation. That's passive-aggressive behavior. It's like when I share about a comic strip that said where the angry parishioner comes out at the end of the sermon and says, "Pastor, I shared all this information with you last week about my life, and here you had to go and preach about sin." You know, I mean, so it was someone who's thinking, "Well, you're talking to me." That's a passive aggressive act, and we hopefully don't do that on purpose. Third one, obvious, lying. Lying. I just went ahead and said lying because sometimes people lie, and sometimes boards lie, and sometimes if we're not careful, we'll catch ourselves slipping into a lie, and that's a communication killer. Because man, if you're ever found out, hurt your credibility. And I have to say, I've visited churches, and I won't name them, they're in other states or anything, but I've heard pastors, and even, you know, I've taught preaching over the years, and I've heard students even preach a sermon and give an illustration as if it were their own, and sitting there, and I knew, no, that's not where, that didn't happen to you. I know who that happened to. I met the guy that happened to. And now with students, I'm able to talk to them and go, "Okay, that was a mistake on your part." That's going to cost you, not just in grades, but that'll cost you in your ministry. Because if somebody else were sitting there who knew the same guy I knew that you just stole the story from, they're not going to trust you as much for a while. It's going to take you a long time to rebuild that trust. It's a form of lying. Other times, I've just had to just go and say, "Wow." You know, because I don't know the person, but I know that they're stealing the story. So that's a form of lying that we sometimes fall into. Another one, triangulation. Anybody hear of that before? That is, I wrote an article about that in Holiness Today, so you can look that up if you want someday, but when you're bored. But triangulation is when two parties, instead of confronting each other directly, try to use you or me as a buffer in order to avoid direct confrontation. You with me? So, the husband comes to you and says, "Would you tell my wife that she needs to stop blah, 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 Pastor?" Exactly. Or the wife, and then the wife comes to you and goes, or when you, if you were to tell her, which smart that you didn't, but if the wife comes to you and goes, "Will you go back and tell him?" You know, it's that kind of thing, right? Where they try to pass the information through you instead of allowing you to do what you're called to do, and that's facilitate them coming face to face. Triangulation is a killer. I share a story in the book that I won't get into in detail, but in that very first pastorate, right, to show you that even though I had made this neat little thing, I was not a communication guru by any means. Because in that same first pastorate, I actually got involved in a triangulated counseling session with a married couple, where the husband shared with me some stuff that I found shocking, about his nice, sweet, demure wife. And the next time she came in, he was an inconsistent attender. She came every week, and she finally came and said, "We need to sit down. My husband is being very verbally abusive and very, you know, our marriage is on the rocks." And I made the mistake of saying, "Well, it's probably because you and I shared the husband's little info with her that he had passed through me." It was his way of not having to confront her on her issues, and then it became her way to justify not talking with him more. They ended up leaving the church, I'm sad to say. I don't know. I mean, I'm not happy about that or proud of it. But that was, I went home and I told my wife, and I should have, you know, been smart. I get smarter as I get older. I ask my wife before I do dumb stuff more often nowadays than I used to. And so I went, "Honey, you won't believe that," that's not their name, "but the Smiths left our church. They're leaving our church. I don't think we'll ever see them again." "Why do you think that, Charles?" I said, "Well, remember I told you they're having a little conflict here and there?" "Yeah, yeah." And I said, "Well," and I started describing how that ongoing, my attempt at pastoral counseling, which really wasn't, which ended up with several conversations with them individually, and the last and the only time I saw them together about their marriage, they came in, and guess who they were mad at? Me. I'm thinking, "I didn't do all this terrible stuff to you. You did it to each other." That's what I'm thinking. But they came in and they yelled at me for about 20 minutes. "And we've got to leave this place because this place has nothing but bad memories about, you know, you trying to interfere with how we get..." And I'm just thinking in my mind, I'm just sitting there stunned, but I'm thinking, "I'm just trying to help you dysfunctional, mean people," you know, and say that. But I was thinking it. I probably would have said it today, but I didn't say it then. And I'm thinking, you know, I just thought that I was helping. "You weren't helping at all, blah, 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 blah." We're leaving, and they left, and that is the last I've heard. That was a long time ago. It was the last I heard of them. So I start telling my wife this story, thinking I'm going to get a sympathetic ear from my sweet wife, who's going to say my poor husband was picked on by these people he's trying to help in the pastorate. And she just looked at me and just kept nodding, you know, shaking her head like, so I was talking, just, "What are you doing? You know, what are you doing, dear?" She goes, "Charles, that's called triangulation." You know, and I'm trying to make, I'm like, "Strangulation? I thought about that." She goes, "No, triangulate." And she described this to me. Now, of course, I eventually took that course in seminary. And man, when the professor got to that part, I went, "I know what that is. I've done that. I did that last year." Anyway, so... But that's a communication killer as well. Of course, then there's just a couple more I want to give you, and then I'm going to give you a case study just to take home and mess around with if you want to, or you can share with your folks. But there's two more. The next one is bullying. You know what that's about. We don't have to describe that very often, but bullying is often accompanied by a lot of external and internal pressure. That's what bullies thrive on. Time pressure, internal pressure, external pressure, like numbers or whatever for pastors are giving. That's usually an external pressure. An internal pressure would be some kind of relationship thing. "No, Pastor, you don't understand. These two families came when I came, and if I leave, they're leaving." It's that kind of stuff. That's an internal pressure, relationship pressure. That's what bullies in the church thrive upon. Now, bullies on the playground, they just want to beat you up. Thankfully, I've not yet had a church member want to do that, although I've had friends who've been threatened physically. I've never been threatened physically, but I've been threatened in other ways. Welcome to ministry, right? And every time you're threatened, either with internal pressure, external pressure, or relational pressure, you're being bullied. Congratulations. You're being bullied. They may not even call it that. Which I've directed back before. I've gone, "It sounds like you're bullying me right now." And they've looked at me like, "How dare you call me a bully? I wasn't bullying. I'm not. I wasn't bullying you, Pastor. I don't bully you." "Well, yeah, you were. And here's how." And I defined it. You exerted relational pressure on me. Or you tried to exert an internal pressure, threatening your giving, or threatening the functioning of the church. Or you exerted external pressure. "You're going to leave if I don't meet this ultimatum." All those, I said to them, "That's bullying. Is that what you're trying to do?" You know, just calling it what it is. But bullying is a communication killer. Now, to be fair, we pastors, if we're not careful, we can bully too. Yeah. I mean, again, Even our prayers. Yeah, yeah. Give us an example. I mean, we could pray out. We have the mic, right? Is that what you're talking about? Even our public prayers, right?
Private place to bully people or preach to them through our word.
Right. In fact, right there, you've got two communication killers in one. You've got passive-aggressive communication and bullying at the same time. The double prize, right? And again, yes, every time we do it, it's not worth the people who respond. In other words, it's all the bad that's done is not worth any quote-unquote good that we might think comes about. Because in the long run, it just torches our communication, it torches our credibility, and it becomes a way that we're identified in the congregation. And again, maybe you, all of you have seen in some way, I'm sure. I've talked to, you stay at a place for a while and they go, man, you start talking about the history of the church. I'm like, and I've had people say, and I won't name the church obviously, but in other places where they've said, you know, that guy was such a bully. He would send us these hateful memos. He would send us these, you know, I mean, talking about the pastor. Oh, he was such a bully. Oh, if we didn't show up for what he thought, man, he would just, you know, scourge us in the sermon or in the board meeting or guilt trip us to death or, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So what do you do if you in your heart really believe that the Lord's showing you this is the way you should go and you kind of know the particulars, but you get resistance and you can't bend to that? You
right.
really have to go the way you're going and gently and carefully and kindly, but wouldn't that get into the bullying?
Well, it depends on how you do it. I think the gently, carefully, and kindly is very important because sometimes we neglect that. Sometimes we are right, or maybe we might be actually right, or we might just be right in our own minds, or a combination of the two. Well, according to the Scripture, being right is not the final judgment of whether something is right. Isn't that true? Speak the truth in what? Love. So apparently, if love is absent, even if I'm correct, truthful, I'm wrong. And if truth is absent, even if I'm being very loving, I'm wrong. And I've done both, by the way. I've been very loving and accepting, and but forgot the truth part. Forgot to be honest and just appeased. Well, I've actually not spoken the truth. I've actually been unethical. And I've also, again, done the other way. I've been darn right. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even right about this, by golly. And not been loving, gentle, kind, and walk away, even getting my way, going, I was wrong. I was wrong. And, of course, if we do it right, eventually, if they give us another chance, we can come back and go. And I've had to eat crow, just like all you guys probably have had to. I've had to sit in board meetings and go, you know, a couple months ago, I appreciate us doing this. But the way I approached this, I think, was wrong. And I'd like to ask for your forgiveness for that. And what have I just apologized for? Well, for bullying. Basically, I've apologized for bullying because of the way I did it and the spirit with which I did it. Now, and I'll say this and we've got to go, but that also goes back to, is this a deontological thing? Is this my duty to do it no matter what the consequence? Or is this a decision that can be governed by consequence? In other words, can I take into consideration the consequence of my action as a determiner of right and wrong? Okay, that's a good question to ask. Because there are some things that we think are just duties, but they're really not, right? And we've seen that. But there are other things that we feel in our heart, we know through sound scriptural reasoning and all that, that are just, look, I'm going to have to do this no matter what, right? You know, again, there are some things worth dying for and some things aren't, I guess we'd say it in that way. Or there are some things worth losing people over, and there are some things that are really not. I mean, they're really not. I want them to be at times. I want everything I decide to be worth losing everybody over, but it's really usually not. And I have to make that assessment based on speaking the truth in love, that Christ-like.
And the hardest part as a pastor for me was when I was bullied by somebody, just not bullying back.
And yes.
To actually just let it go.
Yeah.
I had one time where somebody came to me, I talked to them, said, this is the way it is. I'm sorry, I cannot preach other than what the word says.
Sure, sure.
You want me to interpret it differently? I'm sorry, that's not what it says.
Right.
And I've prayed about it, and I have backing and so forth. They don't like it.
Right.
They then went out and said, well, he didn't like me, anything, that, and
right.
so forth, and I just had to bite my tongue.
Yeah.
And yet I look back.
Right.
And
yeah.
That's exactly
following what the crucified Lord. Right. You're going to get you crucified.
Sometimes
yeah.
do that.
That's now, there are times.
The other side.
That's right. You're right. You have to just take it. There are times when you don't. There are times when you can say, like, call it out. Or identify it for what it is. Well, this sounds like this to me, and so I can't do this. But yeah, there are many times where you just have to go, yes, I did that. Yes, I said this. Here's what I meant by it, but this is where we are. And this is just where it's going to be. And again, if we sow that ethical, loving, Christ-centered approach into our congregation over time, the beauty is, they begin to go. I mean, the times when I knew in a ministry setting where it was going in a healthy direction was when I had like board members or the church members go, Pastor, we know you, and we know that they just had to. They're our friends. They are dear friends. They've been here 15 years with us, but we even told them, well, you're just going to have to go. Now, when you can get a Nazarene to say that to another Nazarene, you have been healthy sometimes, most of the time. Because, you know, I've been on the other end of that, unfortunately, in a codependent church, if I can say it that way, or at least codependent leadership at times, where I've had them go secretly, hey, Pastor, I get where you're coming from, but man, they're our friends, and we're just going to go with that. And I was like, well, okay. I mean, is that what your ethic is based? I mean, is that your bottom line? I mean, my contention is, of course, that shouldn't be your bottom line or mine. I mean, there's a different bottom line. Let me hand you these before you go. God bless you guys. Thanks for hanging out with me, man. I appreciate it.